The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Canada, I am away for the last 3 days of my summer vacation, and Ed Morrissey has been kind enough to drop in again from Texas, where it's, I think, 140 degrees, and sweat a little bit in his studio down south. He goes to the Dorn of the studios, as opposed to the Winterfell of the studios where I'm hiring out. Go for it. Go for it. Thank you, Edward, for coming in.
Good morning, everyone. I'm here in Texas at the ReliefFactor.com studios, which are cooler than the other side of the pillow. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com. Welcome back, everyone. Got a great show for you today. We're going to have all sorts of great guests here. Selena Zito is going to drop by, King Banyan, Brian Westbury, Francis Rocha, all the way from the Vatican. We've got lots to discuss today. Right off the top, though, let's go with probably the biggest news story of the last couple of days, which is the mass shooting in Highland Park, Illinois. And what we're finding out now about the shooter, now that he's been arrested and he's been charged, we're finding out that there were certainly red flags about this particular shooter. And not only were there red flags, but they took place in a red flag law state, which apparently nobody bothered to use. Now, this is we're going to hear a lot about this case in terms of the gun law that just passed. The gun law that just passed provided financial incentives for states to set up various different programs to deal with potential threats, including red flag laws, although not exclusively red flag laws. And this is a case where you would have expected these types of laws to apply. And in fact, they were actually available. Let's take a listen to cut number 19 from the police presser yesterday.
What was the follow up from safety? Was there any monitoring given what had happened of
the
social media accounts?
Do you
want
to speak to that?
My name is Master Sergeant Delilah Garcia. I'm Public Information Officer, Deputy Chief. So basically in September of 2019, ISP did receive information from Highland Park Police Department. And at that time, the individual named in the report did not have a FOID card or anything to revoke or to review. So at that point, that FOID part of it was our stance on that.
And there was nothing done to say this person shouldn't be able to get, is there any FOID card in the future? Is any action like that taken?
Well, that at that time, basically, so he didn't have a pending application, so there was nothing to review at that time when we got that notification. We didn't know, and you know, a few months later, something else would happen.
What would state police have to have done or have to have seen in order to try to involuntary commit someone based on those facts and those things?
Involuntary commit someone?
Right. So the police came.
So what was revealed in this, I'm not sure that this really came across very well in the clip, was that police were called to Robert Cremo or Crimo's house twice in 2019 based on threatening comments that he was making. In one of those two visits, police removed 16 knives, a dagger, and a sword from Cremo's home, but they didn't have probable cause to arrest him. Now, they didn't have probable cause to arrest him, but they removed 16 lethal weapons. None of these were firearms, apparently. 16 knives, a dagger, and a sword. This had to do with threats that he was making at the time, at least some of which were for self-harm and some of them were harm to others. So there was, very clearly something going on here. I mean, if you go once to somebody's house, that's one thing. If you go a second time, that's a sign that there is an issue going on here. He had 16 knives. He wanted to kill everyone, according to the quote, and had previously been suicidal. He was in the 18 to 21 year age
age bracket, which is an age bracket now of increasing concern when it comes to potential for mass shooting incidents. And Illinois has a red flag statute, and it doesn't require some states. Law enforcement can't issue the red flag law, and there's good reasons for that in terms of protection of constitutional rights. But Illinois is not one of those states. Illinois is actually not a great state when it comes to gun rights anyway. But in this particular case, law enforcement can initiate a red flag petition. And that law enforcement that responds to these can allege that a respondent poses a danger of causing personal injury to himself, herself, or another by having in his or her custody or control, purchasing, possessing, or receiving a firearm. If you're called out to the same house twice because a guy is threatening to kill everyone and you've had to remove 16, you know, knives, daggers, and a sword from this person's residence, that should have been enough to trigger the red flag law that would have prevented this particular person from purchasing a firearm. Now, I'm not blaming law enforcement for the mass shooting. That's not my point. My point is, though, that if you're talking about putting in red flag laws and thinking that it's going to stop these incidents, it might in theory, but only if law enforcement is using those tools and the family around these people are using those tools to make sure that this person can't get get their hands on a firearm, at least legally, and this suspect was able to purchase this legally. And to underscore the point about the family, my understanding is, and I'd have to double check this to be clear, but my understanding is that the family or a member of the family, I think it was the father, assisted this guy in purchasing that firearm. And later on, Fox News talked to the suspect's uncle, and that's cut number 20, to find out what the family knew about this. Let's listen to cut number 20.
At times, and there was no signs of trouble. I saw no signs of trouble. And if I did see signs, I would have said something. But there was no signs of trouble.
What was he doing with his life? He was 22. Was he going to school? Was he working?
I think he was out of he didn't go to college, and he was like a YouTube rapper. That I know, but I never even previewed his videos at all.
Yeah,
I just know that he's on YouTube.
So he was trying to do rapping and
yeah, he's a rapper, and then he's also an artist. He was a good artist a while back.
Was he professional? Was he getting paid for it?
No. He drew good.
Did he have a job?
At Panera Bread, he worked for maybe 2 years ago.
A couple of years ago.
Yeah.
But he'd been unemployed.
Right.
And no mental problems or psychological problems in the past?
Not that I know of, no. He's a real quiet kid. He keeps everything to himself, and he doesn't express himself out. So he just, like, sits down on his computer, and there's no interaction between me and him.
Now, again, I'm not blaming the uncle for what happened here. That's not the point of this. But clearly there's blinders on when it comes to the family here. The police were called out to this kid's house twice. They'd confiscated all his weapons one of those times. He was threatening to kill everyone. That's a pretty clear sign that there's something going wrong with this kid. So, I mean, the idea that, well, we didn't see anything going wrong. You know, there were no signs. There were plenty of signs. And so the bottom line here is that if you're going to have these types of laws, if you're going to rely on the idea that, you know, background checks and red flag laws are going to work, you have to have people who are willing to use those laws in the first place. And I think that there are plenty of opportunities for abusing the red flag process. There was a lot of discussion about domestic violence accusations, mutual domestic violence accusations, how that could tangle up somebody's constitutional rights. This is not one of those situations. This is a situation where law enforcement had to be called to intervene twice on behalf of somebody who was 18 years old or older at the time, who was threatening to kill everyone and had accumulated a number of edged weapons apparently for that purpose.
I was under the understanding that the left wants to confiscate weapons, and if we just took the if we just took the guns away, we wouldn't have mass murder anymore. We wouldn't have mass events anymore. We confiscated this guy's weapons. And he just chose he chose to get a different weapon.
And they chose not to prosecute. They chose not to process this. I mean, again, the police intervened enough to take the weapons away, but didn't intervene enough to refer it to a committal or to refer it to prosecution, either of which would have also stopped him from being able to legally purchase the firearm that he used in Highland Park. I mean, it's very frustrating. The bottom line here is that if you're going to pass laws, you better start enforcing them. Otherwise, you're never going to get the benefit that you seek from them. I'm Ed Morrissey from Hot Air. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. It's Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com filling in for Hugh today. And joining me now is one of my good friends, Selena Zito from SelenaZito.com. Contributor to the Washington Examiner, CNN, New York Post, and Selena is, of course, as you all know, has her finger on the pulse of America, and she has a new piece, or came out this weekend at least, over at the Washington Examiner, arguing that we are moving in a center-right direction. Selena, is this really a realignment that we're looking at here?
Good morning. This is a realignment, and realignments take forever, but they always seem to shock people that are involved in politics. But this realignment began obviously in 2016, right? We saw that with the big wow factor. But since then, in 2020, people were paying attention to the big race, the Biden and Trump race. However, if you look down ballot, the country became way more conservative in state house races, state legislative races, Congress. Republicans are supposed to lose 20 seats. They, surprise, won 14 seats.
Right.
But that also then continued into 2021, not just with, again, the big ticket races of Virginia and Jersey, excuse me, but also in municipal races all across the country, where row offices in counties all went Republican, not all, but, you know, there was a giant shift, you know, even in a state like Pennsylvania, where county row offices, and that might not sound sexy or important, but it is, it tells you the direction of the country, and in particular in suburban areas in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, where many analysts thought were lost to the Republicans. The voters came back and you see that with this upcoming wave, in this cycle. And what I think is most interesting is these voters moved under enormous pressure, What do I mean by that? Our cultural curators in corporations, in the NFL, in Hollywood, and places like Disney or their neighbors with all the signs of hate has no place here. And, you know, all those and all the protests, they still went conservative despite our culture telling them you're a bigot if you do. And I think that is, you know, a very important thing to pay attention to. Now you look at the Supreme Court. And that is sort of a result of these voters moving to the right, because we now have constitutionalists in there who have on prayer, on the Second Amendment, on religious liberty, on life, have moved the country back towards where it rightly belongs, which is center right, which is where the country really is. And I think that is what, you know, we are seeing. I mean, for years, you know, prayer has and anytime prayer was at a municipal meeting or at a football game, there was a trigger message by the activists that essentially took it out. Now that's gone. You can say a prayer at a football game if you're a coach.
Right. And I think you really hit on a key point here, is that the Supreme Court shift to the right really does reflect a realignment that's already been taking place for several years.
Right.
And to your point about, you know, certain offices, certain local offices not being sexy, before November 2021, you could have said the same thing about school boards. And
right.
After that, yeah. Though, this has become really a central focus. Before the last couple of years, you could have said that about district attorney races. Now that the progressives have won a lot of those races through this progressive, you know, decarceration project, the results of that are making those offices sexy again. And I think that part of this realignment is a realignment back to the local, right? And that's one of the reasons why it's a center-right movement. They're trying to get realignment back to the local.
Right, that's exactly right. And you saw this localism, the seeds of this, actually begin in 2009, 2010, and in that off-year election and in those midterms. But people didn't quite understand it. They thought it was a one-off. Actually, what's going to end up being, you know, and I've written about this before, and they also saw the realignment that caused Trump to win as a one-off. What the one-off is going to end up being is Joe Biden.
Yep, that's exactly right. SelenaZito.com. Go there to get links to all the work that she's publishing these days. That Washington Examiner column is really good to take a look at, so make sure that you're following her on that. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Roller coaster. That's a good description of economics these days. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com from the ReliefFactor.com studios in Central Texas. Joining me is my good friend King Banyan from St. Cloud State University, also on KYCR in Minneapolis, TwinCitiesBusinessRadio.com, where he has a Saturday morning show on all sorts of economic questions. And the big one, of course, is, are we tiptoeing into a recession here? King says,
what
else King
yet.
Says? Not yet. Yeah, I mean, you and I have talked about this now for a couple of weeks about, well, you know, we're looking at this indicator, we're looking at that indicator, bond inversions, you know, the Atlanta Fed, you know, tracker and all that. There's all sorts of people, all sorts of indicators that people are using to say, we're in a recession, we're in a recession. And you are a voice of at least calm, saying we're not there yet, but.
Right. But's very important. I mean, there's all kinds of news coming in and things changing rapidly. It does seem like financial markets are changing their minds fairly rapidly, swinging from things are great to, oh, my gosh, recession is around the corner here pretty soon. Ed, I think one of the things we probably should talk about is sort of how recessions are measured, who puts the date on them. When do they start and end and so forth? So I think that because I think there are a lot of people who just want to say, well, I'm in one already. And I think that's mood affiliation more than it is actual economic science at this moment.
Well, and there's good reason for that. People's buying power is shrinking. You know, you've seen interest rates going up. It's going to make cars less affordable. It's going to make houses less affordable. You know, people who are trying to sell houses now are starting to feel the pain of how that's going to impact their ability to sell. So, I mean, it might feel recessionary to people, but that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, the personal experience is the macro experience here.
Right. And certainly in different groups, I think it's the case that if you are somebody who actually was able to work through the pandemic in 2020, but you still got all those big checks, right, from stimulus, you probably are sitting on some savings. And as you look at the higher prices, you think that stinks and you're not very happy about it. but you're spending the money anyway, and that still is going to say that still is translating into high demand going into a world where supply is constrained for a variety of reasons. And so that is not a recessionary signal. But if you're somebody who maybe was in an industry where you couldn't work and you now see these higher prices and they're eating and your savings are gone, it really does feel like things are tough. And I can certainly understand somebody in that situation thinking we're in a recession right now.
So what is a recession? I know that everybody has the popular definition in their head, two successive quarters of negative growth, I'm using scare quotes, of contraction, basically, in the GDP report. But that's not the real definition of recession, or at least it hasn't been for a very long time. Recessions are actually both more technical and more focused, or at least the calling, the definition of it is, and there's a specific process by which a recession is actually determined.
Right. So there's a group of economists, all volunteers, who are part of something at the National Bureau for Economic Research, which is a clearinghouse for lots of economic research. It's a nonprofit agency and organization, and they're called the Business Cycle Dating Committee, which doesn't sound like as much fun as dating for other things. And it's not as much fun, but what they do.
Do you swipe right or swipe left on a recession? I'm not sure.
Right. That's right. Right. So 12 to five, I think it's currently about 14 economists who get together, and they look at their definition is a decline in general economic activity. And so they look at various markets, and so they're breaking it down. And the four major markets they're trying to look at is industrial production, which measures the manufacturing sector. They're looking at personal incomes, and they're also looking at employment. So they look at the labor market. So they look at labor markets and manufacturing markets. They're looking at sales. So what's going on in the retail sector? They look at that as well. So those four measures, when all four of them or three of the four of them tip over, that's typically when when the National Bureau for Economic Research is going to say, I think that's a recession. Different countries do it differently. So, but in the United States, we're actually using this group of basically volunteer economists to do this work.
We are speaking with King Banyan of St. Cloud State University and TwinCitiesBusinessRadio.com. That's KYCR in St. Paul, Minneapolis, TwinCitiesBusinessRadio.com, where King has his show on Saturday mornings, 9 to 11 a.m. Central Time. You can also stream it. And this was something that actually I've been writing about since the first quarter number came out. And by the way, we're at the end of this month, we're going to get the second quarter number out. That will be when you're really going to have to start doing a lot of explaining, because I suspect that number is not going to be very good. But when you looked at that contraction in the first quarter, it was really technical. The other parts of, it was really almost entirely based on a severe trade imbalance. The consumer spending was still up, not spectacular, but it was, I think growth was 2.5%, annualized growth was 2.5%. Business investment was still up. Again, it was lower than it had been before, but it was still in positive territory. So what you were looking at in that minus 1.6% GDP contraction in the first quarter was really a technical result that probably didn't give us any indications of a recession at all. So I think that may just have everybody sort of focused on that, but everybody is focused on that. I mean, there's all sorts of talk about it in Washington. And part of the reason why is the anticipation of what the Federal Reserve is going to have to do to get inflation under control, because the administration isn't doing anything, like, for instance, revamping its energy policy to try to get oil prices down and gas prices down, get more gas supply into the market, which is the real issue here, which would have a positive impact on inflation if the administration would pursue those policies.
Well, yes, many of them would actually increase inflation rather than decrease inflation. And frankly, just selling it. And part of the problem, Ed, is, of course, we do have increased demand for U.S. exports of energy products, particularly to Europe, but around the world. And energy prices are just rising for a variety of factors. And we can cite the war in Ukraine as one of those factors. It's not the only one, though. There's just increased demand in a lot of places. So that's part of the problem. The Fed today is going to release its minutes from its meeting last time where it increased rates by 75 basis points. And so we're all going to be looking in there to see, is this mean that we're going to get another 75 later this month? I think the answer to that, by the way, is yes, we will. And if you want to talk about why recession might happen, it's because a lot of people believe the Fed is going to raise rates so fast that we're not going to be able to avoid a recession, that all these other spending numbers are going to come down as a result. I think that's what I think it's two things we've talked about. One, are we in a recession now? I would say no. Is there a recession in the next 12 months? Well, the chances of that now are approaching 50-50.
Right. I wanted to ask you, King, did you get a chance to see the report in the New York Times yesterday? The New York Times looked up whatever was remaining of Jimmy Carter's economic advisors who were not pleased with the way that Joe Biden was essentially copying their 1978-1979 playbook and was trying to wave him off. This is not the way to go. This is not the way to go. And I thought that was rather remarkable that first off, that these guys are still around. Good for them. They're still around. But secondly, yep. that they're willing to say, look, you know, you should have learned some lessons from the last time we were going through this. And this administration hasn't done that. You have to spend less money. You have to restrict federal spending. You have to get a lot of that debt under control. And you know, there's energy policy issues in there as well. But I just found that remarkable. What did you think of the advice that these guys were giving Joe Biden?
Well, I think the most interesting piece of that advice was, hey, don't do what we say. You know, do what we say, not what we did.
Right.
Is a short version of that. And yes, this White House seems to keep trying to jawbone down price increases from producers, and exactly the wrong producers. We need more energy, and we're telling current energy producers you're charging too much. That's unlikely to encourage exploration, to be polite about it. The other thing to remember about the late 70s is that you ended up having the late 70s is what made Paul Volcker, who still has the reputation as the most inflation-fighting central banker in history. And he got that because he was stuck with the job all by himself. The Carter administration did next to nothing to help him. And Joe Biden, unfortunately, is not giving Jay Powell any help. And indeed, there was a press conference, you might remember, about 2 months ago now, in which Joe Biden said, Jay Powell, it's your job to take care of inflation. We respect the independence of the Fed, which means when the pain comes from a recession, it's going to be entirely 100% blamed on the Federal Reserve. Joe Biden's already picked out his scapegoat, and his name is Jay Powell.
Yeah, but, you know, Carter could have done that with Volcker. Reagan could have done that with Volcker.
Well, it did.
I mean, in the end, it wasn't necessary for that because it ended up working out very well for Reagan in the end, right? I mean, I don't know that people don't elect Federal Reserve chairs. And by the way, Biden appointed Powell. You got maybe 30 seconds. I don't think that strategy is going to do much good.
I don't think the scapegoating will do him much good. It didn't help Reagan in 82
midterms. Yep.
I don't think it'll help this time either.
King Banyan, TwinCitiesBusinessRadio.com, TwinCitiesBusinessRadio.com. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com. We'll be right back.
I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172.
ABBA! Well, you had to get at least one ABBA cut there. I appreciate what Adam's doing there, getting those disco cuts. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com. Rocking to the hits of the 1970s here on the Hugh Hewitt Show from the ReliefFactor.com studio. And I just want to take a moment here to say that, you know, I hate to say I told you so. No, that's not true. I love to say I told you so. Pope Francis isn't retiring. He's not going to follow Pope Benedict into emeritus status, at least not at this point in time. And the idea that he was going to do that was always a lot more about media speculation and folly than it was about actual resources. And the reason why I know this is not because I'm just, you know, a hugely smart guy, but it's because I follow hugely smart sources. And one of the best in when it comes to what's happening at the Vatican is Francis X. Rocha. He's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, longtime Vaticanista, who's coming to us from Rome this morning. It's afternoon where he's at. But Frank, great to have you with us today.
Ed, great to be here. Thanks so much.
So, you know, Pope Francis gave a one-on-one interview to Reuters to basically declare what informed people already knew, that this is not a guy who's looking to retire anytime soon. He just rolled out his reform plan for the Curia, which is not the time to say, okay, well, here's the plan. I'm going to step away now. I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah. He still leaves the door open. He says, right. You know, as you said a few days earlier to an Argentine news agency, he said, you know, only the Lord knows. And then he said he would step down if he ever felt that he couldn't do it. But no, he's not planning to do so at the end of August.
And I mean, you'd know this better than I would, but I mean, there's been all sorts of adjustment issues having two popes, right? You have Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, who's still around and apparently still in good health, who did step down because he felt he couldn't do the job any longer. But that's been a terribly complicated situation at the Vatican. And I think that certainly Pope Francis understands that and has experienced that, you know, personally. I mean, he's had to deal with that situation as well. It's been at least a locus of some conflict. And I don't think that he'd be too keen to rush into a situation where suddenly you've got three popes. I mean, I think that would be something that he'd want to avoid at this point in time. What is your read on that situation?
Well, a lot of people agree with you. I personally don't think he would let that stop him. He said at the first year of his pontificate, when he was down in Brazil, he was speaking to some Argentinians, I believe. He said in Spanish, "Hacer lío, make a mess." That's probably practically the motto of his pontificate. And I honestly don't think that if he thought it was time to retire, I think he would shrug and say, okay, so there'll be two Pope Emeriti, deal with it. That's the way he's done with it. He's been very disruptive. So I personally, but a lot of people agree with you, that they think that would give him pause. I don't think he'll retire because I think he's too attached to the job. I can't imagine him retiring, frankly, unless he were truly incapacitated. Pope Benedict felt his strength wasn't up to it, but he's still with us. Pope Francis, you know, maybe if he had some terrible stroke or something and he couldn't function, but, you know, I wouldn't expect him to retire. I expect that he'll sooner burn out, as a colleague of mine said, than retire, because of the pace, the terrific pace at which he continues to operate, even though he's frequently been in a wheelchair recently.
Yeah, and Frank, I think that's an interesting point too, because I think that, you know, in the beginning, well, not just the beginning, but through several years of St. John Paul II's pontificate, he seemed to be thriving in that role. I mean, he really did. He was vital, and this is before the Parkinson's really began to wear on him. Did a lot of traveling, was, you know, did a lot of media, made the pontificate perhaps the most significant it had been in terms of world affairs than it had been in quite a while. And I get the sense that Pope Francis is certainly not in the same way, but is also still very vital in this and still is very much engaged in this job, which is another good reason, as you just pointed out, that he probably wouldn't want to step down from it. I mean, I don't see him slowing down. I know that he's had a knee problem that's put him in a wheelchair, but he's still traveling. He's still engaging. He's still kind of talking off the cuff, which is one of the unusual aspects, or at least different aspects of this from the previous two pontificates.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just the other day, on a Saturday morning, his official schedule alone, only for the morning, included four private meetings, separate private meetings, and three speeches to three different groups. And then that's not to talk about the afternoon unofficial schedule, which is usually very packed. He does lots of things. Like, for example, when he met Elon Musk, the other day. He did right. that in the afternoon. It wasn't on his official schedule. He's constantly working, writing, making phone calls. It's absolutely astonishing. The man is 85 years old. And whether you like what he's doing or whether you dislike it or whether you have mixed feelings, he's a phenomenon in that way. Now, it's true that his knee problem has slowed him down. We're supposed to go to Canada in the last week of this month with him. And if you look at the schedule, it's much, much more limited than usually on these trips because he just has going to have trouble moving around. But otherwise, he's certainly not slowing down.
We are speaking with Frank Rocha, Francis X. Rocha on Twitter, at Francis X. Rocha. Wall Street Journal, veteran Vaticanista, a great resource. If you're not following him on Twitter, you should be following him right now, especially if you have any interest in what's happening at the Vatican. And you mentioned travel, and this is another issue. I don't want to say issue, but it's another topic that's come up, which is whether or not he's going to travel to Moscow and Kyiv in an attempt to intercede in the war there. This has come up a number of times. He's gotten some criticism for not being a little bit more decisive, let's say, on the side of Ukraine, who was very clearly the aggrieved party here in this invasion. But, Francis is trying to keep the traditional Holy See role of mediator open here. And he did mention, I think it was in the Reuters interview, that he is still trying to work out a trip where he can go to both Moscow and Kyiv. And he wants to do Moscow first because he said that would be the proper order. Does that sound like it's coming together? It sounded like it might be a little closer or a little bit closer to fruition than it had been over the last couple of months.
Well, his language was a bit ambiguous as of so often, but he said it was possible that he could go to Ukraine, but that he wants to go to Moscow first. And today, the Kremlin kind of threw some cold water on that. They announced that there have been no substantive discussions regarding any such a visit. Sounds like from their end, they're saying there's no progress toward anything like that. It's pretty clear that the Russians have very little interest in him visiting or in him playing a mediating role. As you say, he's sort of made that the condition because the Ukrainians would love to have it. And the Ukrainian ambassador the other day tweeted that, look, the Pope has to accept that the Russians are not going to let him come, so he might as well just come to us, which they would love to have, but he won't do that because if he does that, it'll be seen as taking sides and it will just anger the Russians. So I think he'll continue to offer himself in that way. But for various reasons, I just think it's very unlikely that Russia would ever want the Pope of Rome to be the mediator,
Right, right.
The Russian Orthodox Church wouldn't want that either, probably. Now, it might be more realistic that he meet the Russian Patriarch, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, in September in Kazakhstan on the sidelines of an ecumenical event, interreligious event, I think. But if the Patriarch has decided he's not too irritated by the Pope's finger-wagging comment that he shouldn't be Putin's altar boy. But I think the Russian Orthodox Church has an interest in having pictures of him with the Pope and everything. It sort of gives him a certain respectability at this moment. So maybe that will happen.
Frank, I was speaking with former Ambassador Rooney, Frank Rooney, to I think it was a few days ago. It was right before the holiday. And he was very frustrated at the Vatican's lack of action on the Russian-Ukraine conflict. He was saying that he felt that the Vatican should be weighing in more heavily on this and using its diplomatic power to force Russia into talks. Do you get a sense that there is any of that frustration within diplomatic circles at the Vatican or within the Vatican itself at the moment? Or do you get the sense that this is really, it's really just Pope Francis's show and everybody is following along with that?
Well, I know that some people are frustrated that the Pope doesn't speak more clearly against Russia and censure Russia more in a sort of unqualified way. And there are people even within the Vatican who are troubled by the Pope's suggestions that, well, maybe NATO provoked Russia Right. You know, I mean, he's been very clear that he thinks the invasion is terrible and that his sympathies lie with the Ukrainians. But then he doesn't, I mean, a couple of times he has uttered the word Russia or Putin, I think only in informal remarks and interviews and press conferences, not in actual official statements. But his basic stance is this is a terrible thing that has happened, but and let's stop it. But the way to stop it is not wars, which kind of raises the question about whether he thinks Ukraine has a right to defend itself. I think he has said in some way that it does, but he really is not crazy, clearly not crazy about the idea of arming Ukraine more. So it kind of adds up to a kind of position of impartiality or neutrality.
Francis X. Rocha from the Wall Street Journal, thank you so much. Be sure to follow him at Francis X. Rocha. Be sure to read what he writes. That's how you stay informed about what's really happening at the Vatican. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com. We'll be right back.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.